Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Humans and seeds have gone together for as long as there's been civilization. Now, seed of all kinds is facing a new world. Last week, a mountain vault in Norway began to collect millions of seeds, and new voices are rising to warn of dangers, even in the opportunities of genetic engineering. This hour, On Point, we're talking about the world's stock of seed, the very seed of life, and where it's headed. We will go in this hour to Norway and the head of operations at the newly opened Arctic Seed Vault there, and to America's Great Plains and a biotechnologist who welcomes new high-tech varieties of seed. But first, today, joining me from Sacramento, California, is Claire Hope Cummings, environmental journalist and lawyer who's been covering food and agriculture for many years. She's worked with farmers in Hawaii and Vietnam and in her own backyard near San Francisco. She's author of the new book, Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds. Claire Hope Cummings, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom. It's really nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. Michael Pollan, who's written a lot about food and got a lot of Americans' attention, says, without being alarmist, you've written a most alarming book. What are you saying, Claire?
Well, I hope people will wake up to this idea that seeds are basic to our survival, and this genetic diversity you were talking about, with the, what puts food on our table, if people don't think of seeds very much, but if they think of lettuce and tomatoes and the sweet corn in the summer, the things we really love, it all comes from seeds. And about 75% of the genetic diversity that we've been depending upon for our food supply is gone. So I really welcome this seed bank idea that the government of Norway has done to preserve the seeds that we have left now. We're going to need them.
So give us your thesis. First of all, what's whittling away at that much genetic diversity? Why is diversity diminishing? And what is it that you're maybe justly alarmed about?
Well, agriculture's changed dramatically in the last 30 or 40 years. We've industrialized agriculture. Most people know that. And it's been highly productive, but it's been at a price because it pollutes the water. It changes the soil. So companies have gotten involved to create seeds that are more productive in many ways, the hybrid seeds, and they've been very successful. But as part of that, they've also become private property, and they've also become narrowed in terms of the genetic makeup of those seeds. So where it used to be, what you mentioned, and I was in Vietnam, farmers there maybe plant a handful of varieties of rice, three or four, mostly the hybrid varieties of rice. And yet there are about 10,000 varieties of rice just in Vietnam alone. So we have this magnificent heritage from forever. You know, our relationship to seeds goes back to the beginning of time. And we've been able to call upon all of those different traits and all those different kinds of seeds for a very long time to support a wide base of agriculture. But that base has been narrowing and narrowing as research has been focusing on just a few varieties. And those varieties, once they become commercial products, they become just a few, a handful of things that we plant. Maybe there's about, I think, 50,000 edible plants in the world, but we're pretty much relying on about 5 or 10 of them, wheat, corn, soy, just the basics, right? We used to have 7,000 or 8,000 varieties of apples. Now we only have a few hundred. So again, there's this like a funnel effect coming down, and we're going to need all of that genetic diversity, because as climate change begins to change, not just the weather, but the soil temperature and moisture levels and rainfall patterns, and all these things are going to start to change. Plants need to be able to keep up with those changes in order to keep their productivity. So plants have figured out how to adjust to climate change for eons. But the climate change that we're facing now, that we're talking about with global warming, is going to happen a lot faster in unpredictable ways. That's the uncertainty I talk about with uncertain peril, the environmental uncertainty that we're facing, and the need to have that wide range of genetic diversity to be able to adapt to these changes.
So I'm looking here at numbers from the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. 80% of corn types that were around in the 1930s, 80% of those are gone now. In the United States, 94% of peas are no longer grown. Maybe they've got the seeds somewhere, but they are no longer grown. You know, I'm sure we'll have, I don't know, farmers listening who will say, well, thank heavens for these seed varieties because they let me bring in the big crop that feeds the world. And others, we know about the local food movement and people concerned about genetic engineering who may be wary of this. But describe the system for us, Claire Hope Cummings, that has winnowed this diversity down. I mean, how does it work in practical terms? Are you against the genetic engineering that brought us the Green Revolution and fed the billions that people feared would starve? And you know, how does it work that all those other seeds have been put by the wayside or are actually no longer even around now?
Well, yes, I am against the genetic engineering, and I'll tell you why. This particular technology has been developed actually by agrochemical companies to replace chemicals, or that it could replace chemicals. It's basically the same system where it makes plants resistant to pests or to herbicides. In fact, most GMOs are Roundup Ready type of crops like soy or BT corn, where there's this bacteria been genetically engineered into the corn. So what
meaning the farmers can use Roundup to kill the weeds, but these are Roundup Ready in that these seeds will survive. They'll thrive in spite of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what it takes to genetically engineer a plant so that it doesn't die when you spray a huge lethal herbicide dose on it? I mean, that really asks a lot of a plant.
Yeah, I understand. On the other hand, can you imagine what it takes to chop all those weeds out of those fields? You know, I grew up on a farm, and I don't know how many years I spent walking bean rows with a hoe. I mean, that was a lot of work, and we've got, headed toward 9 billion people to feed.
Well, now you're talking about something important, which is the role of labor in agriculture, you know, and it has always been, you know, we invented the tractor in order to improve labor, and now we've got chemicals, and then we have these GMOs. So it is constant pressure to reduce the demands of labor in agriculture, but there's a price for all of that. There's the narrowing of the genetic diversity. There's the pollution. 90% of our streams are polluted with these chemicals. They're in our bodies now, and the soil is being, you know, mined basically for its health. And as you know, actually the best economic side of agriculture is organic farming. And not only does organic farming protect the soil and keep the water clean and produces healthier food, this is what's paying off for farmers now. And this is the kind of technology, the technology that does control weed. There's a lot of ways to control weeds other than the very expensive hand weeding. Some farmers still do it, but you know, this is what it comes down to, Tom, and I think you raised a really good point. It comes down to what kind of technology is in the best interest of our health and safety as we're facing these environmental perils. Is it going to be the industrial form that's controlled by a particular group of corporations who have profit in mind, or is it better to have an open source technology that protects the environment and provides healthy food? That's the choice I think we're facing.
That makes it sound just as big as it could be. You've got some tough charges in here. You say faulty science, corrupt politics, false assumptions, top-down control. Take us into those. Faulty science. What's the faulty science?
I do go in the book into the birth of biotechnology and how it was developed. A lot of people don't realize it was actually purposefully developed as a method of controlling the biological world. It was not some discovery that they came up with and suddenly realized how they could do it. This was a purposeful thing, and it does have a sort of a resonance of eugenics and how we're going to control, using genes, we're going to control the world and solve social problems.
But isn't agriculture itself all about controlling the biological world? I mean, in the Garden of Eden, in the state of nature, you don't have amber waves of grain. You've got, you know, prairie grass.
Well, you do. And prairie is a great example.
Try and feed Chicago off raw prairie.
You can. That's the whole point. You know, you look at Wes Jackson at the Land Institute, and he's showing how we could use the prairie to perennialize our crops and do it better and with more fertile soil and protect the environment and be just as productive. And that's the point. There's a whole bunch of public policy questions that are raised here. I mean, I know you asked me about the science, and I'll get to that in a sec. But the public policy problems are driving this. You know, we've been subsidizing this industrial model for a really long time, and we're paying for it in our health, and we're paying for it in our budget and in trade problems all of that.
We've seen some of that, and we've looked at it on this show, but you must concede that agriculture is, sort of by definition, the control of biology.
Well, there's a relationship. Okay, that's right. In other words, I wouldn't necessarily say control because you have a choice. You can dominate. You can be like a miner and you can extract the fertility of the earth and put it out there.
Many different kinds of control, but we're not hunter-gatherers anymore.
Well, but the point is that if you have a relationship like organic farmers do, where you work with pests, then you kind of get into a situation where the pests have a role in that farm, on the farm, but they don't take over and you have to kill them with these lethal chemicals. When you start spraying and when you start taking this kind of dominant control and the extraction from the soil, you end up with a sick system and you have to keep constantly dumping chemicals and constantly tweaking, as you said. Whereas if you keep it, there'll always be another aphid. That's one of the parts of my book. Is there, you know, we have another bug disease.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have these disease-resistant bacteria and we have resistance going on. Nature's always going to find a way to come back at us. Okay, so if we have a relationship with that natural world, then we can base our productivity on that rather than on just the dominant form of kill in the war on bugs. It's not a war we're ever going to win.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world's stock of seed for corn, for beans, for everything. Now a subject of controversy and concern as Norway opens its doomsday seed vault in the Arctic. My guest is Claire Hope Cummings. Her new book is Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds. Later in this hour, we'll hear from Norway and the guy who runs the vault in the mountainside up there in the Arctic. Claire, let's go to some listeners. Alex is calling from Stanton, Virginia. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Great conversation. First, I want to say that the narrative that Ms. Cummings is telling us is very compelling. It's a great caricature, but it's not very true. And in fact, the most sustainable farmers are the ones who are controlling weeds with the very soft herbicides like Roundup, which are used on wildlife preserves rather than the organic methods of tillage because of the soil erosion and the sustainability concerns.
But what's the caricature? I mean, we are genetically engineering in all kinds of ways in agriculture. That much is true. The cave in the mountain in Norway is real. What's the problem with the picture?
My concern is that we're putting the meme of anti-corporate concerns ahead of the real challenge, which is feeding humanity sustainably with as little impact on the environment as possible. And if we're going to do that, we can't do that with nothing but a toolbox full of ancient tools.
What's your experience? Where are you coming from? What do you know about it, Alex?
Well, I'm an ag analyst and a plant physiologist by training. I'm at the Hudson Institute, and this issue concerns me greatly, which is why I purposely called.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, the seed vault prohibits not only genetically modified seeds, but seeds that are protected under plant breeding rights, or even hybrid seeds. And those are the ones that are allowing humanity to feed itself more sustainably and with less land taken from nature.
So you're saying, fine, have a vault, but put genetically modified seeds in there too?
Right. We need the entire toolbox. We're in the 21st century, not the 18th century.
Claire, what do you say?
You know, there's a lot of seed vaults that these corporations do have. They have a lot of private seed banks already. In fact, since they own that genetic material now, they're keeping it in their private ownership. In fact, the whole reason for biotechnology is to patent their inventions. So much of what you can do with plant breeding, you can do drought resistance, pest resistance, crowding resistance when you have weeds and problems like that. You can do that with traditional plant breeds. And by drawing on these major public seed banks that have the great diversity, the reliance that I think I really welcome Alex Collin. I welcome that point of view. I definitely welcome the discussion because we need to make this a national policy discussion. And the question has to be framed correctly, which is, do we want to become dependent on a handful of corporations for all of our food and the way it's been tinkered with from seed to stomach?
But go to his main argument, Claire. He says you appear to be more concerned with corporate control than with feeding humans.
I am. am because I think this is an issue of basic democracy and freedom. If we don't have any way to choose, one of the problems with biotechnology is the public policy. They have forbidden labeling. I'm in Europe a lot, and you get to choice when you're in Europe. You get to see on your labels whether something's genetically modified. That's not true here. 70 to 80% of the food in the supermarkets have GMOs in them, and people don't have a choice here. Why? Because that industry decided not to give people a choice. And I think that's a serious public policy issue. And if we want to have a choice, and actually the surveys have showed that over 95% of Americans prefer to have a choice about GMOs. How come we don't have a choice, Alex?
My point is that what you're advocating is a buggy whip era agriculture. And the places in the world without corporations, that are void of corporations, are the scariest places on the planet and where the environment is the worst off. I'm not pro-corporation per se, but they're very much a part of the 21st century, and they can be a very productive, constructive part of the meeting the 21st century challenge.
Alex, we're going to go to that view. I appreciate your call very much. Let me get one more call before we go to Nebraska. Here's one from Columbia, South Carolina. Karen, you're on the air with Claire Hope Cummings.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I wanted to just share that I have a family member who is a salesman for a major seed company.
Okay.
And his level of contempt for the whole issue of biodiversity, climate change, whatever you want to call it, it just took me by surprise. He doesn't think global climate change exists, so none of this seemed relevant to him. But I wanted to bring up the point of the tie-in with research academic institutions. Here in South Carolina, we have a very prominent agricultural college, Clemson University, and they are heavily, heavily, heavily subsidized by corporate interests with a particular point of view.
And are you glad for that or not, Karen?
Well, your previous caller was talking about this not being a single point of view issue. But, you know, I would like her to address the issue of the kind of research that gets done and who funds it in academic institutions and which way it goes. Because farmers...
And that's a part. That's a wonderful issue.
On small farms are just completely wiped out by the tsunami of corporate marketing
yeah.
and control.
Karen, let us pick it up, and then we'll go to Lincoln, Nebraska. But Claire, on this point?
Oh, it's a very important point. In fact, I think it's one of the top 5 points about this problem with technology or the clash of technologies that we're talking about, because the biotechnology industry has distorted the research agenda, pretty much taken over the great land-grant institutions. And, you know, organic farming out here in California is a huge, productive, and very economically viable industry. And I did a survey with Richard Rominger, a former executive of the USDA, and we asked farmers, what kind of research do we want the UC and the big land-grant institutions to do? And they wanted more research on how to grow crops with a variety of techniques, and especially the biological techniques, and they regretted that none of that information was coming out of the universities. The whole organic movement, which is the most productive and economically beneficial in agriculture right now, and the most promising in terms of dealing with climate change and our environmental issues, and supports the biodiversity you're talking about, Tom. All of that has been neglected by the land-grant institutions in favor of private technologies. Why? Because of changes in public policy that allowed these universities to patent their products. So we've gone to universities who take this money, public money and private money, and they turn it into patents which are beneficial to the universities.
Claire, let me go to one of those now, if you'd be good enough.
Okay, great.
Joining us from Lincoln, Nebraska is Michael Fromm. He's an agriculture biotechnologist, director of the Center for Biotechnology at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. Worked for Monsanto for 7 years, led the research team that developed genetically modified Roundup Ready corn and YieldGuard corn. Michael Fromm, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Now, I know you've got a different perspective on this, but jump into the conversation with us. You know, I mean, this vault in Norway and others, they're real. People are concerned about genetic diversity. Modified seed crops have helped feed an awful lot of people. And yet you must be aware of this, you know, sense of unease and more than that that's out there. What do you make of it?
Well, first of all, I think I applaud maintaining seed banks. I think nobody's really against that. There is genetic wealth there that we should preserve. I am against excluding some of our best hybrids and modern varieties and GMOs. I think we should preserve everything. I think the discussion is how to make agriculture the most productive, provide the most healthy, abundant food supply, and in an economic way. I mean, I think the issue with organic farming is every time I go in a store, it's always costs a lot more, not a lot less. And so the question is, what system produces healthy food at what price? And most farmers, which are under tremendous economic pressure to produce a profit, have found what we'd call modern traditional agriculture to be the most productive and cost-effective.
Are you worried that in the interest of helping that farmer make a profit, which they need to do, and put reasonably priced food in the stores, we may at some point in our genetic modification sort of drive off a diversity cliff, end up with highly modified seed that won't be able to adapt to changing climate conditions we drive out the diversity that we may need to fall back on? Do you see the peril that Claire describes here?
Sure. There's a tremendous misconception there that we're focusing on the GMOs and assuming we're ignoring the plant diversity. Modern plant breeders sample as much germplasm as possible, make their modern varieties as tolerant to environmental changes as possible. And then on top of that, they add a few transgenes, GMOs, to confer traits like insect resistance or herbicide resistance. So I think we're totally misconstruing the fact that modern plant breeding is producing the best germplasm that's ever been on the planet.
The UN says 80% of corn types that existed in the 1930s are gone, 94% of peas no longer grown. That doesn't sound to a layman's ear like more diversity.
Let's take corn, for example. The yields up till 1940 are 20% of what they are today.
Oh, I know. My cousin's out there, getting ready to plant right now, and that's great economically. But if it comes back around to bite us, it doesn't seem so great.
Wait, I don't understand what you're advocating. Why would a farmer want to grow something that has 20% of the yields? Let's put it in the germ bank in case we ever need the seed bank, in case we ever need something it's got, like disease resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But modern germplasms move so far beyond the old land races, there's just no product. It's just crazy to try to grow something that has 20% of the yield.
Yeah, Michael, stand by. Claire Hope Cummings. Here's the argument. It gives us food that's abundant. That's
yep.
Important. We got a big pop that's economical, that lets farmers stay in business, and the corporations are not irresponsible. They have an interest too in maintaining this readiness to go with changing circumstances.
Right, as a commercial product, and once they patent these GMOs, then they take that out of the public's realm, and I think that's a policy issue that's really important. This mix-up that a lot of people do with feeding the world and GMOs is actually very misleading, because these are industrial products that are used for industrial agriculture, and most of them go for animal agriculture and industry. They're not really feeding people
Those get eaten, too. I mean, the hamburgers have a little
indirectly,
animal in them.
That's right.
Well,
but
I mean,
it's a very inefficient form of feeding the world, and so we need to really look at whether productivity is the answer to the hunger problem, which is a very real problem of real suffering, is just more of this protein. I mean, we have a problem with overproductivity that Michael Pollan points out with our diet and with the obesity. We have a problem with overproductivity and actually using food as for pharmaceuticals and using food for biofuels. This is really mixing it up, but it's being driven by industrial agriculture. And for them to say that they're really able to feed the world when, in fact, it's not a sustainable system raises, I think, really important questions about whether or not people... I think this is a political issue, and I would like to see it be part of the presidential campaign, where people bring up the question of, do we have a choice about what we eat? Do we have a choice about sustainability, the environment, and keeping our water and our soil fertile and clean? And as we go forward into these uncertain times environmentally, what's out there for people to draw on? If it's just one narrow band of genetics and one particular worldview that we're going to manipulate the genes of a plant on a scientific basis, by the way, you brought up, which is faulty, which is that genes produce traits, okay? I mean, the DNA model has been discredited. And this technology has been around for, 20, 30 years. Michael, you know this. And what do we have? We have overuse of herbicides.
If I could jump in for just a second here, we've got such different worldviews, it's almost hard to see where they intersect. Let me get one call, Michael, out from corn country, and then I'll come to you. Mary in Mason City, Iowa, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that here in the heart of industrialized agriculture in Iowa, where I grew up on a farm in the 70s and 80s, there is a growing movement of farmers and consumers who are demanding food that is locally grown, freshly grown, and that is not genetically modified, not messed with. And there is a group in Decorah, Iowa, called the Seed Savers Exchange, that is putting seeds in the vault in Norway as we speak. And they are very committed to saving heritage seeds and to growing and offering these seeds to people here in Iowa who would like to raise their own crops or raise crops and sell them to people who are demanding that sort of food.
Mary, it's good to know about. But what about Michael Fromm's perspective that you need abundance and you need food that doesn't cost too much and there are a lot of mouths to feed and we need this industrial agriculture?
Well, like I said, I grew up on an industrialized farm and I now am the mother of three children. And I don't want cheap food. I want food. I want to put in my body and the body of my children food that is healthy and that will nurture us and that will sustain the environment. And so if I have to forego my big screen TV so I can buy healthy food, then so be it.
Mary, thank you very much. Michael Fromm, what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, I think it's great that some people like organic food, but there's no evidence or proof, scientific proof, that it's any healthier than any other kind of food.
Actually, that's not true anymore.
Well,
there has been some
great
studies.
Now it's my turn. You listen.
Okay.
There's lots of people. There's some people that believe that, but again, there's no scientific proof that one type's better than the other. So that's a consumer choice.
We note Claire's dissent. We note your point. Yes, and further.
Fine, but let's keep it a preference.
But you heard Mary, and what do you say to her perspective?
Well, that's fine. Again, I think people that have personal choices, for whatever reason it's based on, but it doesn't seem to be good, hard science, they're allowed to do what they want to do, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But I think it's a misrepresentation to say, oh, it's healthier. They may believe that. That's their choice. But there's no science that says one type of production is any healthier than the other. And I think that's important.
And Mary says she hopes Iowa farmers grow more varieties and maybe some of those heirloom seeds and take it back. Are you worried at all about kind of monoculture,
Again, this is a tremendous misconception. We're mixing GMOs with what plant breeders are doing. There's roughly 400 different varieties of modern corn that fit different geographies across the U.S., all of which have different germplasm in them. And that's coming out of these massive breeding collections that have even more diversity that they keep mining to fit the changing environment. So right. there's no evidence that the germplasm's narrowing for the type of traits you want in modern agriculture. The old land race varieties are dropping because they're not very productive. But any good genetics that they had would probably be incorporated in the modern varieties.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world's stock of seed for corn, for beans, for everything. Now a subject of, for some time now, of controversy and concern. We're talking as Norway opens its new seed vault up in the Arctic. We're going to go there in just a moment. I've been joined in this hour by Claire Hope Cummings. Her new book is Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds. Also from Lincoln, Nebraska, by Michael Fromm, an agricultural biotechnologist at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. I want to go straight to Norway now. A lot of interest in this in the seed vault there. Joining us from Oslo, Norway, is Ola Vestingen, coordinator of operations for the Svalbard Seed Vault. He's a scientist with the Nordic Genetic Resource Center. They, along with the Norwegian government and the Global Crop Diversity Trust, all run the seed vault. Ola Vestingen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So tell us about the vault. What kind of countryside is it in? What, on a mountainside? And how much seed is already in there?
Well, the vault is placed up there on the Arctic mountain Svalbard. The vault sits just outside the small town Longyearbyen, and it's carved into the mountain there, a sandstone mountain, about 125 meters into the mountainside. And in there, the entrance tunnel leads to these three vaults that can preserve up to 4.5 million distinct samples of seeds.
And how many seeds are in there now? You've begun taking them in, and what kinds of seeds?
Well, there's all kinds of seeds. We have about 268,000 seed samples now, so far. And this is just the beginning, of course. That's about 100 million seeds. And it's all kinds of seeds. It's a lot of the common crops like rice and wheat and maize. About 72,000 different varieties of rice already. But there's also less common crops like, well, at least in Norway, sorghum isn't a very common crop, Bambara groundnut, amaranthus, a lot of different species.
And what's the point of them being in a cave in a mountainside in the Arctic? Do they need to be frozen? Is it to protect them from, I don't know what, you tell us.
Well, the seed vault was constructed to be safety backup for the already existing seed banks around the world. And Svalbard is the perfect place for that. It's safe and secure, and it has the permafrost. So since the vault is carved 120 meters into the mountainside, you actually have natural cold conditions. Now, it is also artificially cooled down to minus 18, which is the temperature optimal for seed conservation. But even if the electricity fails us, we would have -4, -6 degrees.
So you've gone to a lot of trouble and a lot of expense to do this. Why? What is the fundamental reason or importance of this seed vault?
Well, the seed banks around the world are absolutely crucial for agricultural development. As we heard, everyone agrees that diversity is key to adaptation. Now, many of these seed banks holding this diversity are sitting in areas vulnerable to natural disasters, vulnerable to wars, etc. And since 2004, we've had a UN treaty, the International Treaty of Plant Genetic Resources, and that really provides us with a framework for collaboration. And the seed vault is constructed in that spirit.
You live and work in a country that where genetically modified foods are banned. So is that part of this? Did you build this vault? And I guess you have no genetically modified seeds in the vault. Have you built this vault to protect a seed stock from genetically modified seed or science?
No. That's not the case. It's right that Norway has very strict biotechnology laws and regulations, and it has been decided that the seed vault shall not accept deposits of genetically modified seeds based on those rules and regulations. But I think, as we heard earlier in the program, mm-hmm. no matter what model of agricultural development you believe in, no matter if you're a conventional breeder or you're using genetic engineering, we agree that genetic diversity is important, and it's not a GM issue. This, I think, it's a genuine collaborative effort to conserve a resource that we all depend on.
We want to go further on that front with you, but let me take a call, if I may, from Buffalo, New York, and Russell. Russell, you're on the air with Ola Vestingen in Oslo, Norway.
Hi, Tom. The reason why I was calling, I'm not very sophisticated about this, but what I was curious is, who has access to these seeds later on? I mean, can small farmers and indigenous people around the world access them as easily as, like, wealthy corporations? You know, who gets to get those seeds if they need be?
Yeah. Mr. Vestingen, how about it? Who can pull them out of the vault? For what?
Well, that's a good question. The seed vault is, as I said, a safety backup site for already existing seed banks, and the property rights to these seeds will remain with the depositing seed banks. So that means that only the seed bank that has sent the seed can withdraw them. That's a fundamental principle.
Does that mean governments send them, or academic institutions send them, or?
I'm glad you asked, because the seed vault is open to all collection holders of of seeds as long as these collections are publicly available, and they have to be available under facilitated access.
So not likely to be corporate contributors then, I guess, with that proviso.
Not likely to be corporate, no. But we have, as we heard earlier, we had Seed Savers Exchange, an NGO from the U.S., and we also have the National Plant Germplasm System in the U.S. depositing seeds. So,
but do you expect farmers and researchers coming and going, shuttling back and forth off this mountainside, picking up seeds, or is this really, at some point, way hundreds of years down the road, or who knows when there's a catastrophe?
Yeah, exactly. Who knows when there's a catastrophe, and who knows when there's a local disaster or catastrophe affecting one of the gene banks that have sent their seeds to Svalbard. And we have seeds already now from the National Gene Bank in the Philippines, and they were actually, that seed bank was actually hardly hit by a typhoon about 1.5 years back, and a lot of accessions got lost, and samples were destroyed, and they now saw the need for having a safety backup, and we're very glad to have them on board now from the beginning.
So we've got the picture from the mountain cave in the Arctic. Olav Estingen, please stick with us. I want to now turn this back into the conversation we've been having and let our listeners join it. From Fairfield, Iowa, Jeffrey's calling. Hi, Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Yes. I've worked with more than 30 scientists over the last 2 years to identify all of the known health risks associated with genetically engineered foods.
What kind of scientists? In university settings or corporate or?
Oh, yeah. University, independent, corporate.
Okay.
And we have put together a book, Genetic Roulette, and it identifies thousands of toxic and allergic reactions in humans, thousands of sick, sterile, and dead livestock, and damage to virtually every organ and every system studied. We also have shown that the basic assumptions used for approvals of GMOs have been turned out to be untrue, and that the national and international processes for assessments are not competent to even identify most of the health risks that we're exposed to.
Michael Fromm, help us here.
Let's take a very specific example here. So there's a bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis that can kill insects. And in fact, organic farmers use this. They spray it on their crops. In that bacteria, there's 3,000 or 4,000 genes making 3,000 or 4,000 proteins.
Okay.
The genetic engineers have taken one of those genes to make one of those proteins and put it into corn, which now kills European corn borer.
Mm-hmm.
That has several benefits. European corn borer, if you've ever grown sweet corn, is that
yep.
big caterpillar in your corn, ear of corn there.
Sure.
It likes to get into the ear and it likes to get into the stalk.
Makes it ugly.
And on average, it causes about a 10% yield loss. And if there's a strong wind, it can blow, snap the stalk. So it provides the farmer an increase in yield, some benefit from catastrophic failure when the insect pressure is high. Usually he won't spray because spraying is not very effective, but if it does, it costs some money. It's still not very effective.
So you're saying it's in nature, now it's in the corn.
Not only is it in nature, but organic farmers use it.
Well,
let
me just go to my caller first, and then I will, Claire. But Jeffrey, you hear Michael Fromm's response. He says, come on, it's in nature. We use it too. What's the problem?
It's an excellent choice of example. When BT spray was sprayed in Pacific Northwest in Vancouver for gypsy moth infestation, about 500 people complained of allergic type reactions. Now, hundreds of Indian laborers who are picking cotton that produces its own BT toxin are complaining of the same allergic reactions. They allow sheep to graze on that same cotton plants after harvest, and about 10,000 sheep died, one out of every four sheep. There's about 24 farmers in the Midwest that claim that BT corn caused their pigs or cows to become sterile, and farmers in the Philippines and in Germany believe that it killed their livestock. Even Monsanto's own study of BT corn fed to rats for 90 days showed evidence of toxicity in the liver and kidneys. Most importantly, the only human feeding study ever conducted showed that genes can transfer from the DNA of the corn and the soy into human gut bacteria.
Jeffrey, we've got it. It's a big litany. Claire, I'll come right to you, but Michael Fromm, our listeners have it chapter and verse.
As far as I know, there's no credible scientific evidence that BT causes any kind of health risk. And you've got to put this in perspective that, you know, BT corn's been out there for 10 years. Literally billions of people have eaten it, and there's not a single documented case of any problem. For instance, if there's an allergic reaction, you will have antibodies in your blood to that protein. People that have complained of being allergic, when tested at their blood level, which is not an opinion but a science fact, have never been found to have any antibodies.
Claire Hope Cummings,
so,
what do you say?
There are people out there that, you know, try to make claims for whatever reason, maybe to get a lawsuit, or whenever it's gone down to a credible scientific level, there's been nothing to it.
Claire?
Well, we could go into the battle of experts forever on this issue, and I'd rather get back to the importance of biodiversity and genetics that we really absolutely need to have in the public interest and to have these public collections. It's a favorite tactic of industry to divert us into these specific arguments because, you know, you can go on forever. My expert says, my science says.
But, of course, it does matter. We're talking science and genes and exactly what's what.
Well,
it does matter.
Actually, the science is on the side that Jeffrey is talking about, and the science is on the side of the health of the organic farming systems. But, you know, like I say, we don't have that kind of time. I would love to congratulate the government of Norway and the Global Crop Diversity Trust because seeds and that diversity that they're putting aside for the public interest is the point because these are commercial products, Tom. They are not something that's being done for public good. They're corporations who are doing a product and they have a right to do that, but it's just a commercial interest and let's get that straight. It's not about the public health. It's not about hunger. It's not about all of these other great issues that they like to kind of cloak themselves in. It's about profit.
Well,
and what we really need to talk about here is genetic diversity and what is in the public interest because they're diverting a lot of these genetics into their own seed banks.
Let's go to Norway to do that while we're lucky enough to have Ola Westingen with
us. Yeah. Let me just say that this public policy question, Tom, is the issue here. And Norway has had the foresight to say, let's keep this common heritage of humanity available for all people, farmers, everyone.
We've got that. Ola Westingen, you hear this is kind of an intractable, insoluble argument at some level. You said earlier that you didn't put this vault together to protect things from genetic modification. Where do you come down? You're at the Nordic Genetic Resource Center. Do you see genetic modification of seeds of our food stock as a problem or as an opportunity, an advantage?
Well, I mean, it is a problem that that old varieties are being lost because they're replaced by new varieties, but that's really the same whether it's conventionally bred varieties or it's genetically modified varieties. And I think it's a matter of a market failure, actually, that we very often fail to conserve what goes out of fashion. And what we're losing, we don't really know. And the seed vault was constructed to conserve as much as possible of that unique diversity found within our crops, found within the farmer varieties, the land races, and also the more modern varieties. And that's really our focus.
Ola Westingen in Oslo, Norway, coordinator of operations at the big seed vault that's opened up and taking seeds now in the Norwegian Arctic. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me get one last call here. Tim in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tim, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Great program, vital topic. Hope you can cover future aspects of it. You've got a lot of commentators. In brief, I think that Claire's points need to be hammered home here, especially the question of sustainability. That is, in the future, you're not just concerned about maximum output and all the corporate hoopla about increasing production. You're concerned about being able to have a solar sustainable agricultural system. And what, in fact, the corporate types are pushing for is greater and greater petro-intensivity. That's a suicidal direction to go in. You can't have more and more people dependent on fewer and fewer crops that need further and further subsidies from petrochemicals when you know you're running out of petrochemicals.
Tim, our time is short. You're right. We need more time on this, and we will come to it again. I thank you for your call. Michael Fromm, a last word. We've seen oil up at, what, 105, 106? Does it matter in your world? Do you agree with Tim?
There's no question high energy prices impact everything, including agriculture, from fertilizer inputs to fuel costs. But at the same time, GMOs help reduce that. You know, no-till agriculture reduces the amount of cultivation needed, reduces the fuel costs, and helps conserve soil as well as organic matter. So, you know, these are important questions to try to preserve our environment, produce healthy food, and we want the best science and best policies to do that. And I think it's good to discuss that, but it's got to be on a rational, scientific basis, not a polarized political one.
Michael Fromm at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, our time runs down. We're grateful to you and hope you'll come again. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
Claire Hope Cummings, wow, what a picture. People really, you know, all over the map on this, and you hear it. There are all kinds of interests here, food on the plate, corporate interests, public interest, as you say. Where do you see public sentiment going on this, Claire?
Well, I think as people learn about what's available and what is being lost, that they're going to say, we want to have these public seed banks. We want the seeds on the farms and in the forests and in the plant systems. I think people should understand, as I say in my book, whoever controls the future of seeds controls the future of food. And that matter of control, I think we should keep it in the public interest. That's my background. That's my point in the book. And I really do appreciate the public debate we're having here, Tom, on Point's doing a really good job on this.
Claire, thanks. Claire Hope Cummings. The new book is Uncertain Peril, Genetic Engineering and the Future of Seeds. Thank you so much for being with us, Claire. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.